Hello again, everybody, and welcome again to Back to the Future, the podcast that chats today to the people who are going to make tomorrow happen. And joining me this time around to make tomorrow happen is Christian Bosch. Christian, you're very welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Obviously, from your title, you're a doctor. You're also an author. You're a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics, but also, and I think probably more relevant to quite a lot of our listeners, you're a director of the Center for Global Affairs, the Global Economy Program at the New York University, where, let's think about this a moment, you specialize in leadership, in entrepreneurship and social innovation. So all quite meaty and timely subjects of the moment. But where did it actually all start with you?
Yeah. Well, you know, I used to be that kid in high school. I was thrown out of high school, had to repeat a year, probably had held the unofficial world record of how many dustbins and trash cans you can knock over on your way to school when you're driving. And then one day wasn't so lucky anymore and crashed into four parked cars, all cars completely destroyed, including my own. And I won't forget the policeman who came to the scene and he was like, oh my God, he's still alive. And, you know, that idea that I was supposed to be dead, that stuck with me. And I asked myself all these weird questions, you know, if I would have died, who would have come to my funeral? Who would have actually cared? Was it all worth it? And at that point, I had essentially only kind of very depressing answers. And so it took me on this intense search for meaning, trying to figure out what is life all about? Why are we here? You know, and if I run in front of a car tomorrow, was it worth then? So how can I make sure to make it worth it? Kind of instilled this urgency. And I started reading this amazing book, highly recommended for the times we live in, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which is all about the question of how do we find meaning in tough circumstances? And what I realized is I find a lot of meaning in connecting ideas, connecting people, and that kind of spark that comes from bringing those together. And so that brought me on the road of kind of community builder, entrepreneur, social entrepreneur, and then later into academia.
Well, so really you were, I guess, being forced to think about legacy and do what some of us would call backcasting, where you look at your future and then you almost go, wow, I've got to work back from that point to now and then decide what is the most effective way of getting to that place tomorrow.
Absolutely. Well, and that's the really interesting thing, right? That in a way, I mean, the reason I'm so excited about topics sort of related to serendipity and how we can cultivate is that, you know, life, the only thing that's really sure in life is that there will be so many unexpected things and we have to somehow do something with it. And the question was being, right, do you let yourself define by it or can you somehow try to shape some of this while having some kind of sense of where you're going? And so that kind of tension I've been extremely curious about. Is there something that we can do to have some kind of idea of where we're going, but at the same time, build a muscle for the unexpected that helps us to make the best of it?
Wow, interesting. Because when I told people that you were going to come on the podcast, a few people said, wow, yes, the man who believes in luck. Now, it sounds like you are probably talking about luck in some ways, but, and I guess some of them were thinking about your book, you know, Connect the Dots, the Art and Science of Creating Good Luck. So to you, luck isn't really something that haphazardly chances upon us, I guess.
It's a great question because, you know, when we think about luck, a lot of times we think about this kind of blind luck, right? So things that just happen to us, passive, you know, being born into a nice family, stuff like that, that we can't really influence. But then I'm really fascinated by this active luck that serendipity is, the idea that we can turn the unexpected into positive outcomes. And, you know, kind of a lot of my work has focused on that question. Because when over the last 10 years, especially, we looked at what makes people truly successful in organizations, but also beyond in life in general, the one theme that came up all the time was they somehow are really good at turning the unexpected into positive outcomes. And people would always say, oh, my God, this person is just lucky and so on. So and they would always say, no, I really worked hard to be luckier. And so it's really that fascination of saying, is there a way to work harder to be luckier versus just always saying I either work hard or I have luck? And so that's kind of what our work focuses on. What's the science based framework for cultivating serendipity, this active luck?
Interesting. I'm going to ask you the question that's, what is the science behind it? Because when I read your book, I was fascinated. I mean, I'm kind of aware of some of it, but I was more fascinated that a lot of what you were using to prove this consensus or the sense of how luck could be kind of created or managed or encouraged had quite a lot of science behind it. So what are some of the things that, if I'm imagining it's all about luck, that I really should know about and understand there's a lot more riding on this than just me, you know, having somebody come and reach out to me and, wow, look, it's happened.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, right? Because to your point, I mean, we're all aware of serendipity stories, right? So everyone has a serendipity story. There's a lot of innovations, inventions that are serendipitous. And so one thing we did was to step back and say, is there a pattern behind this? If you take all these different examples and you try to understand how they unfold, is there something we can take from this? And so that was the first step. And then we, you know, looked into all the literature that's out there in management, in the natural sciences. There's fascinatingly much research around how you can make it more likely that serendipity happens, because it's a probability question, right? It's essentially you're trying to increase the odds of something positive happening. And so we kind of brought all this together, and we can definitely go much deeper into the science there. But the key is really to say, okay, usually when we think about luck, as said, we think about it as an event, right? So something that just happens and that's it. But when we looked at all these different incidences of serendipity, it turned out that it's always the same process of somehow spotting an unexpected serendipity trigger and then doing something with it, imbuing meaning in it. So take the example, you know, if you have erratic hand movements like I do, you spill a lot of coffee. So imagine you're in a coffee shop and you spill coffee over someone, and that person looks at you slightly annoyedly, but you sense there might be something there. You don't know what it is. You just sense there might be something there. Now you have a couple of options, right? One option is you just say, I'm so sorry. You walk outside and you think, what could have happened had I spoken with that person? Option number two, you start that conversation and that person turns out to become the love of your life, your co-founder, you name it. The point is our reaction to that unexpected moment, making the accident meaningful, is what turns it into serendipity. And so I'm a huge fan of looking, for example, at things over time where we studied, for example, a business incubator, where you would look at entrepreneurs who bumped into each other and then unexpectedly had an overlap. But then we looked at it over time. So what do they do with it? Is there anything that comes from that? And only if they actually do something with it, that's kind of serendipity found, versus if nothing happens, that's kind of, in a way, serendipity missed, right? And so that's always the fascinating things, that we can also understand those counterfactuals. What could have happened, but actually it didn't, because they didn't act on it. And maybe the last point on this, Martin, is really that that gives us agency. That gives us the power to somehow not say it's only uncertainty that's out there and I'm powerless. No, there's a lot of things we can't pick, but what we can pick is our response to it and then doing something with it.
So I'm guessing what you're also reminding us is that we have to be the agents. We have to be proactive. Potentially, I guess, in that proaction, we have to be strategic, as well as just, you know, it can happen accidentally. But to your point about the, you know, the coffee shop encounter, we could choose option A, not to speak. But what you're saying is that if we choose option B, which could be about speaking, that in itself can open up or unlock other benefits and opportunities. So I think the key thing is really about connection or connecting, where a lot of our lives are spent maybe not being proactive in connections and not connecting. That what you're saying is that by virtue of connecting, you're increasing the opportunity to allow the not just serendipity to happen, but potentially success or a different sense of you know, how we potentially can make it in the world around us.
Absolutely. And that connecting, you know, it can be with people, right? That's where a lot of times serendipity happens, when you kind of have that unexpected conversation. And I'll give you an example in a second. Or it could be from reading a book and having that unexpected idea. Oh my God, this could be a podcast, right? So it's about connecting dots between people, between ideas, and then kind of doing something with it. And I'm a big fan, actually, to your point, right? If we try to kind of drill down, what are some of the elements that can help us to have more serendipity? One is around these kind of, you know, the aspects you just mentioned, which I think are extremely important. And to me, that comes a lot back also to what is holding us back to having more of this. So if you take that coffee shop situation, right, a lot of times something might hold us back from, even if you see the potential serendipity, right? You might see that that could be a person you want to spend time with, but you might not act on it because of, you know, fear of rejection or imposter syndrome or you name it. And so I'm a big fan, actually, of stepping back and saying, if I look at all those moments where serendipity could have happened, but it didn't, in that meeting where I had the unexpected idea, but I didn't bring it up, in that kind of at the event where I ran into the speaker but I didn't talk with them because I felt shy. Things like this. And then really thinking about what is the pattern behind this that I can work on? Is it fear of rejection? Great. Let me reframe it and say, hey, we always think about what's the worst thing that can happen. But once we realize that regret is actually the worst thing that can happen, when you walk outside and you think, what could have happened? Then you reframe it and say, what's the worst thing if I don't do this? And then actually fear of rejection tends to fade away. And you're like, okay, actually, I should make that. So to your question, I think the first point is a lot of times really working on those underlying deeper fears and self-limiting beliefs. And then the second point is really around what are practices we can all use to then build our muscle for it, right? And we can talk about strategies like the hook strategy and other things, but it's really a lot about this openness to the unexpected and saying, how do I understand that serendipity, potential serendipity is everywhere, whether we open our eyes to it or not. And that's kind of a lot of times where there's a lot of experiments where we can show that the openness to the unexpected predefines a lot of times the outcome.
Right. I think actually the notion of the unexpected is key to it. And I always spend my life as a forecaster, I guess, reaching out. So I always think, you know, what are those anomalous things I should be looking for? So I alert myself to the notion of, the anomalous in the first place, because most people are looking for, I think, familiarity. And I'm always looking for something that's a bit dissonant, a bit disruptive, a bit odd. So that the odd things that suggest something is on the move. I think the second thing, which somebody once said to me, you know, Martin, it's not just good enough to observe these things. It's forever being able to reach out to them, to your point, that even if you try to touch 10 things and only one works out, well, then that one has worked out. But if you don't do it, the chances of failure increase every time you don't do it. And the third, I guess, point that you've sort of touched on is when we're doing these things, a lot of people feel they should do it in familiar spaces. So, you know, you talk to your strong ties in your network. You talk to people who are you're most familiar with, where I think a lot of research shows that it should be the opposite. It's people who are unfamiliar and people that are not necessarily close to us may contain the more useful observations or insights to help us achieve our particular goal or to, you know, kickstart this new innovation or idea.
Absolutely. And there's actually two things that come to mind there. One is to your initial point around how looking out for anomalies, I think that's at the core of it, right? To take the example of the potato washing machine, right? The potato washing machine, a couple of years ago, a company in China called Haier, huge white goods manufacturer, they received calls from farmers. And the farmers told them, your crappy washing machine is always breaking down. Why is it breaking down? Well, we're trying to wash our potatoes in it, and it doesn't seem to work. So what would we usually do? We'll probably say, well, let's educate the customer that they shouldn't wash their potatoes in there because the machine, our marketing plan says the machine is made for clothes, not for potatoes. Now, they did the opposite. They said, you know what? That's unexpected. But there's probably a lot of farmers in the world who have a similar problem. So why don't we build in a dirt filter and make it a potato washing machine? And so that's kind of like those anomalies, right? That once you observe them and then do something with it, lead to really interesting innovations, inventions, and so on. And I'm a big fan of simple things in organizations, like asking in the weekly meeting, what surprised you last week? What it does is it primes people to look not only for, oh, this confirms our plan, but actually the opposite, to say, oh, this questions our assumption, and that's great. Let's make it part of the plan. It's not a threat to our authority. It's not a threat to the legitimacy of the plan. It's actually showing that you have a good culture that allows you to consistently make the best out of the unexpected. And that's really the second point that came to mind, right? When you were speaking about the importance of having diverse sources of information, of bouncing ideas off and so on. I think that's what really good leadership is about, right? To say, how do I give people a sense of direction to show there's a common denominator? You know, if you are MasterCard and want to bring 500 million people into the financial system, that's a goal you have. Now you bring in people from local communities as much as from the company, as much as from other parts who could all bring in different ideas with the same idea of where we're going. And I think that kind of, you know, finding that balance between having some overlap so that people actually have a reason to connect and to connect the dots with each other, and at the same time, diverse enough to actually realize, you know what, Hilda in Cape Town might know more about Cape Town than the CEO of MasterCard here in the office in Purchase in the US. That actually helps you then to come with the really interesting ideas. And I think that, to me, by the way, the discussion misses a lot of times. Like, there's all this kind of diversity discussion, which is, I think, extremely important. But unless you find then the common denominator in terms of a core value or so, you actually isolate people even more. And I think that's really important to think about, what are the common denominators that bring us together and make those kind of things happen.
So it's sort of the accidental overlaps that you have, the, I guess, moments where we, you know, brush against. I mean, if you think about it, a lot of the time we're with like-minded people. And if you think about our clubs, organizations, institutions, they're always about like-mindedness. You know, we share things in common. And I think, to your point, it's first of all, people that we may have very little in common with, but we're looking for those moments that can open dialogue and potentially, to the point about the you know, potato washing machine, that can not just open a dialogue, but allow us to develop a solution, an opportunity that suits all parties that partook in that dialogue in the first place.
Absolutely. And, you know, I feel the way we ask questions and we respond to questions is a huge, huge part of this, of identifying those potential underlying overlaps that we might not be aware of. I mean, imagine you go on a holiday to Italy and you kind of randomly meet this fisherman or fisherwoman on the beach, right? You might think, I don't have a lot in common with them. I'm kind of like, you know, doing this exciting thought leadership and podcasts and things. And this is a person who spends their day on the sea. Like, what do we have in common? But if you switch away from the kind of what do you do, where they would essentially just say, I'm a fisherman and I'm going out there, to, hey, like, you know, what do you enjoy about it? Like, what is it that makes you, like, you know, something that is a bit more about their motivation, their underlying kind of what makes them do it. They might say, you know what I really enjoy about it is the endlessness of the sea. And you might be like, oh my God, this is why I love knowledge. It's about endlessness of philosophy, right? So the point is then you kind of find all these unexpected overlaps. And so I think shifting questions away from what do you do to what do you enjoy doing, for example, or how we respond to questions, like casting a couple of hooks. You know, this is one of my absolute favorites, by the way. If you want to proactively create serendipity, it's the hook strategy, where the idea is that you bring in a couple of memorable talking points where someone can pick whatever they're most interested in. Someone who does that really well is Ollie Barrett. He's a wonderful entrepreneur in London. He set up Startup Britain and other cool ventures. And if you would ask Ollie the dreaded what do you do question at a conference or so, he wouldn't just say, I'm a technology entrepreneur, right? One box. But he would say, I'm a technology entrepreneur, recently started reading into the philosophy of science. But what I'm really excited about is playing the piano. And so what he's doing here is he's giving you three or four potential dots where you could be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. My sister's teaching on the philosophy of science. You should give a guest lecture. Oh my God, such a coincidence. We're hosting piano sessions. You should stop by. The point is that then we bring out those unexpected, meaningful connections that then a lot of times lead us to a much more meaningful relationship and beautiful serendipity in the process. And so long story short, I'm a big fan of doing a serendipity journal where you just write down two or three things at the moment that you're excited about. Curiosities. Like, I'd love to learn more about plant science, or I just had a baby, so I'm learning about parenting. And then from the most unexpected of places will be the most amazing insights.
Right. So you've mentioned a word there, what I find so interesting, curiosity, and curiousness. And I read a survey recently which suggested that quite a lot of traditional CEOs didn't see curiosity as a useful value within a business. And in fact, some of them saw curiosity as a potential thing that could lead to distraction and diffusion and a lack of focus among their research and innovation and senior development teams. I mean, what would you say to the CEO that said, you know, he, she, they couldn't see any role for curiosity within their business?
What is interesting? I mean,
apart from sacking them, obviously.
No, it's really interesting because you know, it's obviously interesting because depending on which area you're in, right? If you're running a nuclear reactor, you probably want to be in execution mode most of the time and kind of say, okay, these are the kind of things that have to do, and curiosity should be limited to improving that versus kind of you know, trying things out, experimenting, and then the whole thing blasting. And going up in flames. But to your point, I think in most organizations in a fast changing world, we want to move away from just an execution mindset to a kind of learning mindset where people actually across the organization see new things. I mean, we finished a study recently with over 40 of the world's leading CEOs, you know, of companies like MasterCard, Procter & Gamble and others. And one of the key themes there was actually how much they champion curiosity, how much they champion the idea that people should question things all the time, because that's the one way to constantly improve and to think about how do we make this a better product? How do we innovate, quote unquote, around this and so on. And so it's actually, you know, what you just mentioned, that's the kind of old school leadership style, right? I need complete control, But unfortunately, that becomes an illusion of control, right? Because in this world we live in, that's just not possible. And so, I always love this idea that, look, as a leader, I can't give you certainty, but I can give you the clarity. So if I can give you the clarity of where we're going, if I can give you the clarity of this is the plan we have, and at the same time, I let you figure out some of the uncertainty in the sense of what could be an even better way to get there, that's actually where a lot of times the real innovation happens. And that's what comes out of all of our research, essentially, to say, look, if you're a new type of leadership person, you allow people to question things because you know that you can't know everything. But if you don't make that part of the plan, it will always be a threat to your authority. But if you make it part of your plan, then actually you build that into the culture, and then you have a culture that actually incentivizes new ideas.
I mean, it's interesting that you know, most CEOs claim that they're about, you know, ideas. They claim that they're about clarity. They're about, you know, developing a strategy or a vision. And those two particular words, strategy and vision, I think require a lot of curiosity, a lot of imagination, an ability to, I guess, fantasize about tomorrow. So, you know, you've got to have this sense of how you can build a bridge into the future, and then to help people, you know, move along that bridge in a fairly clear, coherent and confident way. What do you think are the kind of other skills that a future facing CEO, you know, should have to tackle the bigger problems that we're seeing in the world today?
I mean, first and foremost, the humility to realize that most of the actual real beautiful imagination and ideas will be in the heads of the people who work for them or with them, hopefully. And so that idea that, hey, look, I have to bring them into that in some way or the other, not only to develop ownership and to make people feel that they're part of it, but most importantly, because usually people who are in different settings know better what works locally than the kind of person in the headquarters who kind of directs it down. So I'm a huge fan of those kind of CEOs who go in and say, let me first get a feeling for what's actually happening here. What can I learn from you first before I come out here and give you kind of my insights into everything? And I think that's, you know, when you look at nation states, we see the same, right? There's leadership styles in New Zealand and other countries where you see that when you have leaders who have a certain humility, they will ask a lot of questions. They will try to understand, why are we doing this? Should we do this differently? Versus coming in with one rigid idea of this is how the world works. And to give you maybe an example there, I found that fascinating, you know, when COVID happened. And there were two very different leadership styles that came about. One leadership style was the old school that's focused on control, rigid planning, timetables, and so on. And the other one was kind of like the one we've been talking about, that's more about saying, give people a very clear sense of direction, give them a plan, but at the same time, build in the unexpected. The first kind of modus was essentially governors of states saying, okay, COVID just happened. We will close down the state in exactly this timetable. And then exactly that time, we will open up again. So an exact kind of rigid timetable, rigid strategy. Then now, right, when a new COVID cluster happens, you either have to adjust the timeline and you look weak, or you have to somehow hide the data, which quite a few people did, unfortunately, and then kind of like, you know, essentially lie to your constituents. Fudge, indeed. The other, the new kind of type of approach would be to say, hey, look, we have certain North Stars principles, which are we want economic health and we want public health and, you know, societal health. Here's an approximate strategy and timetable. So actually, funny enough, usually similar timetable to the other states, right? But I'm telling you already now that I will adjust this timetable based on new information coming in. And that is part of our plan. That's fair. We need to do that because of uncertainty. Now, when you correct the timetable, the plan here, you look like a strong leader because you always told people and now you're looking out for people and you change it. And so that's really what we see in companies as well. If you have a smart leader, they come in with the humility of saying, I know that we cannot know everything, but I can give you a lot of clarity here where I want us to be and where we should be. But then we'll work on this. And so I think that kind of like intersection of having, to your point, the imagination, the vision, what could be, the potentiality, and at the same time, the humility that we might not exactly know how exactly to get there at any given time. I think that's kind of in a way what we've seen a lot in the leaders that we've been working in.
Interesting, because I would say that in, you know, what you've mentioned there requires a certain type of personality and a certain type of skill set, which is about being open, you know, about perhaps embracing chance, understanding serendipity, you know, the notion of how we are less keen, to your point, on control, but also more keen on these anomalies that as leaders we're told to distrust, watch out for, shield our teams or our countries against them. So how do you think, if I don't have those skills and they're not part of my character and makeup, do you think I can be taught them? Or is it really just I should resign and find a leader who's much more flexible and collaborative and creative and open to change? Or is this something I can learn myself?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting because I grew up in Germany, right? We love planning. We love the idea of having things under control. And so to me, particularly, that kind of idea is used to be extremely kind of strange, right? This idea that you have to embrace the unexpected and you should make it part of your plan and so on. And so I guess the point here is this is about mindset. And the great thing about mindset is you can change mindset. It's malleable. You can work with it. And so absolutely, there's a lot one can do. And, you know, Martin, what I found fascinating about this work is I always thought this content would be for people like us who now intuitively do these kind of things, right? Who intuitively cultivate serendipity, then it gives them a language and a couple of more practices to do that. And then what I realized is the biggest change actually comes with people who don't intuitively do it, but who then, once they start with small steps, get so excited about it because they're like, oh my God, I always thought this would be about uncertainty, about anxiety, about kind of somehow interrupting my life. But actually, it might add joy to my life. It might add kind of that meaning to my life that I was searching for, and so on. And so the long story short here is that I'm a huge fan of very small behavioral changes, not kind of, you know, there's only so much you can do going into an organization and say, now change in exactly this way and do this, right? That usually doesn't work, right? But what I've seen work really well is to say, to go in and say, let's do a couple of things differently. Let's start with the kind of idea of what surprised you last week, and then building that in and making and normalizing the idea of the unexpected potentially becoming an ally rather than just a disruption to our plans. And then let's role model this. Let's celebrate this. Let's kind of, in a way, make this a part of our life. And then what usually happens a lot of times is that people find it really exciting to talk about it because now they are like, oh, wow, I don't get shot down for the idea that I wasn't able to plan everything, but rather like now it's being celebrated that I made the best out of the unexpected, while, of course, always avoiding any mistake that's avoidable and so on. And maybe to give you one of my favorite experiments there, just to showcase, you know, that at the end of the day, I think we are very used to look out for the negatively unexpected, but not for the positively unexpected. And I think that's a huge issue because that's where most of the joy in life comes from, right? And so in this one experiment, it's a rather entertaining one, but there's a lot of similar experiments that have been done that show similar things, where they pick people, and maybe everyone who listens to this, I'd love to ask you if you consider yourself to be a lucky or an unlucky person. And then, you know, those of you who consider yourself to be lucky, you might be luckier in the future, not because of some kind of abracadabra falling from the sky, but the way you look at the unexpected. And so to give you an example, this experiment, they pick people who consider themselves to be very unlucky. So people who say, bad things always happen to me, I'm always in accidents and so on. And then a couple of people who consider themselves to be very lucky. And then they pick one of each and they say, walk down the street, go into a coffee shop, grab a coffee, sit down, and then we'll have our conversation. What they don't tell them is that there's hidden cameras alongside the street and inside the coffee shop. There's a £5 note, so money, right in front of the coffee shop door. And inside the coffee shop, one empty chair next to this extremely successful businessman who can make big dreams happen. Now, the lucky person walks down the street, sees the £5 note, picks it up, goes inside the coffee shop, orders a coffee, then sits next to the businessman. They have a conversation. They exchange business cards and potential opportunity coming out of it. We don't know that part. The unlucky person walks down the street, steps over the £5 note, so doesn't see it, goes inside the shop, orders a coffee, sits next to the businessman, ignores the businessman, and that's it. Now, at the end of the day, they ask both people, how was your day today? The lucky person says, well, it was amazing. I found money in the street, made a new friend, and, you know, potentially an opportunity coming of it. The unlucky person just says, well, nothing really happened. And we probably all know those people in our lives, right, who face exactly the same situation, but have very different outcomes. And to your point earlier, right, that yes, if you actually talk with people, it makes it likelier that serendipity happens out of these conversations. But a lot of times it's literally just about opening our eyes. I find a lot of money in the street because I expect it, mostly pennies, so it doesn't really help my lifestyle. But once you look out for money in the street, you start to find it. Kids find more money in the street than adults. Why? Because to your point, curiosity. They're still curious about, and they still expect that unexpected things might be there. So very long story short, once we open our eyes to the world and to the positively unexpected, it tends to happen more and more. And we can all learn this and we can all prime ourselves towards that.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'm having to examine myself as you're telling me this, and I realize that while I am hugely open to newness, and I'm probably like you, I will talk to, being Irish, I will talk to everybody and can talk to anybody, even underwater. And I still feel, and this is maybe to do with how I feel I must structure this sense of seeking out innovation. So I will open actively search for innovation. I will then also look for the early adopters, so the people who are taking those innovations and translating them to the wider community. And I'm always looking at how big those moments, so the innovation is, and how big that group of early adopters are. And what I'm kind of hearing from you is that, yes, that may happen, but the first point of the journey is just to be open. Or, you know, E.M. Forster, when he said about, you know, only connect, that notion that we must connect with people first. And what I'm learning from you is that unless we do that fundamentally, all of those other things, luck, serendipity, you know, chance, entrepreneurialism, the notion of having that successful conversation with a business person, etc., just won't happen. So I guess we really do have to be proactive. And my question is, a lot of us, I'm an oddity, I think you're probably an oddity as well, because we do this without thinking. The majority of people are shy. The majority of people are nervous. The majority of people feel that if they did that to a stranger, they may be randomly accused of being, you know, odd, eccentric, mad, you know, any of the above. So how do people start doing this if they've never really done it before?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think, you know, what I found fascinating, I recently had a conversation with someone who also identifies as a kind of community builder. Like, we love hosting events, we love bringing people together, but actually we're very introverted. Like, a lot of us community builders are extremely introverted and then have spikes of extroversion. And so we found that fascinating, that in a way, you know, we love hosting this big dinner or speaking in front of a group, and then we kind of take ourselves out of it after an hour because we're like, okay, now we got to replenish energy and so on. And so I've always been extremely excited about the question of how do you, in a world that's been designed for extroverts, every conference, every setting, is most of them are designed for extroverts, how do you survive as an introvert without kind of, you know, with actually having a bit of fun? And there's three things that I found extremely useful. One is to think about, who are the people in my life who intuitively do this a lot and with whom I can then kind of work together to do that? So, for example, when I had my book come out, when I would go to a dinner, I would always first talk with the host briefly to get them excited about the content so that they would talk with everyone and then people would come to me and then I wouldn't have to go to everyone and kind of, right, you know, in a way pitch it, but rather people would come over and say, oh, hey, XYZ host told me about it. Like, I should catch up. So first thing is really thinking about people in our lives who in a way can do part of that and then help us a little bit in this. I think the second one, you know, I'm a big fan of thinking about what are the conversations I anyways have to have, right? The kind of routine meetings with colleagues, the kind of once in a month event where I anyways have to go to, things like this. And then thinking about how can I make this the most fun in the sense of, can I use two or three memorable talking points that I just bring in? Because it might actually, especially with colleagues who usually bore me, make it much more exciting if I now randomly bring in that actually I've started new XYZ hobby, whatever it is, doesn't matter. But then actually a lot of times people unexpectedly would be like, oh my God, I didn't even know you'd do this. Like, we should hang out about this, whatever it is. So second thing, really using existing conversations and just kind of making them a bit more exciting by a couple of hooks that we cast into them and think about it. And then the third one really, I think, is also working on these deeper underlying kind of fears that might be there, right? Because I think a lot of times, all these practices, right? Hook strategy, learning how to connect dots and things like this, they're all great and they're extremely effective. But I think it really starts a lot of times when it comes to social interaction with working on our underlying fears. And you know, maybe it's the feeling of worthiness, the feeling of the kind of imposter syndrome that characterizes most high achieving people, right? So you're not alone if you have that kind of feeling of an imposter, for example. And so I think working on those deeper underlying fears. And one thing that I found most useful there is really, you know, as simple as it sounds, to really get started on it in low risk environments. So, for example, if I know I have a fear of rejection, I'm not endorsing this, but what a friend of mine did, he had a fear of rejection. He would literally go to coffee shops. He would walk into a coffee shop where he knew he wouldn't go back again. Anyways, he would go in and say, hi, how are you doing? Can I have a free coffee, please? Just kind of like a kind of random question, but because you know they will most likely say no, you get used to the idea of this embarrassment, this kind of weirdness, rejection. And you do that a couple of times, and then it feels more like a kind of, oh, actually, it's not that bad. And like, then you learn how to play around with it. You learn how to build in a joke. And then actually you get surprisingly many free copies because you kind of like, people find it exciting and funny why you did that and things like that. So long story short, I think, again, I don't think that particular example is particularly interesting or recommendable. But what I am saying is what you'll see with a lot of interesting psychologists, for example, is that they will think about what are low risk ways for people to just put themselves out there in a way that just directly builds the muscle versus theorizing around it, right? I can theorize as much as I want about, yes, great, like, you know, reframe it to what the opportunity could be. But actually, no, the only way to really get over it is to putting oneself out there. And so I'm a big fan of this, just putting oneself out there and getting a lot of rejections to then see how likely it is. I mean, I remember, Martin, I had such a bad high school certificate in the end. I had to apply to 40 universities, and you still had to send these kind of handwritten applications, right? You didn't have like just an email that you would send and like that was it, but you had to send it to everyone. And like literally kind of over 90-ish% just said, no, like this is crap. Like you don't have any chance here. And so I think that kind of thing in a way, of course it hurts in the moment, but then it also becomes part of one's story, right? And it's kind of this thing of, oh, okay, now it somehow is something that in a way wasn't as bad as it felt in the moment. So long story short, I think working on the fear of rejection, I think is a big one.
I mean, I think it's exactly that, because I was thinking about, Matthew Syed. He was saying that, you know, the story of successful entrepreneurialism or successful innovation isn't the story of success. It's absolutely the story of failure and the story of rejection. And, you know, he said it's when you do the next potential failure and when you do the next potential question or ask somebody to help you, he said that's when it happens. But you've got to get used to the failure, which I think is what you were saying, before, you know, success may come about. So I'm just kind of thinking about the sense of how I've listened to you telling me how to change my character, because I'm now going to try these things. I'm going to test them. I'm going to be open to serendipity in a way that I think I am open to it, but you know, you're telling me to take a more positive, curious, proactive stance on it. I'm also going to, I think, learn how to better think about what it is I'm trying to achieve. Because to your point at the opening of the podcast, where you're saying, you know, you really have to look at your life in terms of where you want to get to understand now where you would begin your journey and how that journey would potentially play out. But one thing that occurred to me is that, has it happened where you've set out on a course that you decide that, yes, this is where I'm going to get to, this is the route I need to take, and it hasn't being the most successful, but as a consequence, you have learned something better about either that moment or about yourself or the subsequent future path that you would eventually take?
Yeah. Well, the reason I love that question is because, you know, I've been a big fan of thinking about life more in terms of curiosities and less in terms of passion or purpose. I feel there's a lot of pressure on people. Find your passion, find your purpose, find your one thing. And then you realize maybe that's changing over time. You know, what I'm passionate about now, like, yes, I still love connecting people, but I don't enjoy kind of the community building as much anymore as I used to. And now I enjoy more doing that via content, for example, right? So those kind of things where it might shift what exactly the kind of passion or things are, but the curiosity and really focusing on a curiosity that helps guide us, I found that very useful as a kind of starting point to say, okay, what am I curious about at the moment? And then kind of building on this. And to your point, I've had that a lot in my life, that I thought one way would be the one way, you know, I was involved in setting up a startup, for example, where, you know, in a way, at some point I realized, oh my God, like this is not really anymore what I'm really excited about here. And I thought this would be my whole identity. I thought, you know, if I'm not the co-founder of this, who am I? Right. And so it was a really existential crisis that I had when it seemed like, oh my God, this might be over, this part of my life. And it was a really rough period. But when I think back to it now, the only reason why I feel now I can, in a way, also emotionally relate to people who have faced bankruptcy, why I can emotionally like relate to people who have faced existential crisis, is because I went through that. And I think everything I'm doing now, I'm doing differently because of those kind of experiences. And so, very long story short, Martin, to me, this comes back to that idea that, in a way, the crisis becomes an inflection point if you allow it to become that, right? So Viktor Frankl had this beautiful idea that in a way, look, if you go into a situation, we always look for objective meaning, right? So if you're in a tough situation, where's the meaning here? But maybe a lot of times there might be no objective meaning, but we can subjectively create it. So for example, one thing he apparently did was he was in the toughest of situations you can be in, concentration camp. No, you know, there's no hope, objectively speaking. So he said, I will create some subjective meaning. I will still speak with fellow prisoners to make them feel better. And now I have a reason to wake up tomorrow morning because I still have to talk to all these other prisoners I haven't talked to yet. And so the point being that in the toughest of situations, we can still look at a situation and say, okay, this really, we almost went bankrupt. That really sucks. But actually, maybe now it was the kind of wake up call to say, you know what? We anyways, we're only doing mediocre here. So maybe we needed that kick in the butt. And so long story short, I'm a big fan of this idea of looking at crisis as inflection point for something better. And what we see in our research is that almost every leader will start their story of how they came about and did exciting thing in some kind of breakup or bankruptcy or something that went wrong. And I think that kind of idea of you have agency over not being the one who was bankrupt, not being the one who failed XYZ company, but you're the one who came from that and then made this. And I think that's kind of the interesting agency that we all have.
So I guess, I mean, I would relate to that in terms of the history of our business, you know, 20 years looking at the future, where constantly you're having to reinvent, reshape, reimagine the business because of, you know, shifting market circumstances. And I remember, to your point, somebody saying to me, though, if you reframe failure in terms of, you know, learning and what's it teaching you about the you know, the situation you're in, it is a bit like, well, that's it. So how do you move forward? Because as somebody says, the future hasn't happened. So even if you failed now, the failure doesn't necessarily mean that that will exist in the future. So to reshape, reframe, reimagine, to move forward is probably the thing that I think a lot of people tend not to be able to do because of the, I guess, the psychological impact of, you know, bankruptcy, of failure, of feeling that you're, you know, you're a victim of wider circumstances that you can't control. And I'm going to kind of ask you to keep that moment with you because you're now in a situation which is different. You're in a, you know, moving forward into the future again. We're pretty much in a, not a personal existentialist crisis, but in a kind of vast global one, if you look what's happening in the world. So I'm just wondering if you had any forecasts about how you think or would like us individually or us collectively as a group, as a race, to move forward. What would you see would be your forecasts about the future of either business, organizations, or ourselves as you would like to see it over the next decade?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, I love obviously your work and I think that it's really interesting, the kind of forecasting piece when you do it kind of methodologically as you do it. I think, you know, most people who forecast things, I'm always kind of smiling at the Economist forecast, for example, where you know that most of them will be wrong, right?
Look, absolutely where it's wrong, essentially, yes.
Where it's essentially the point is that everyone who tells us they know what happens in 10 years, I'm taking them less seriously because I'm like, okay, look, you're thinking linearly, you're thinking like AI, right? You're thinking kind of like based on what you know. But a lot of times, obviously, there will be all these unknown unknowns that we can't know about yet. We only need one actual alien in New York to then completely rethink how the whole humankind will develop from here, right? And so the point is, long story short, that I'm a big fan of thinking less about what exactly will the world look like in 10 years to
right.
What are the kind of things we can do now to be ready for whatever comes our way. So how do we build the muscle for the unexpected and then plan as much as we can, but at the end kind of build that resilience and that feeling that we can do whatever comes our way. And Martin, this is really important to me that you mentioned this really important point around that, yes, like some crises hit us so hard that it will be hard to take the agency, right? And I think we can never blame anyone for bad luck. I think we've all had periods where you just feel powerless and then a lot of times actually might be powerless. So I think that is a given. So that's absolutely not. I think we should always kind of like be aware, of course, that there will be periods where we just can't do anything and that feels really, really bad. And then at the same time to our conversation, I think to me, the most important aspect of going forward is the mindset question, because if we get people to be resilient, to be thoughtful, to have imagination of what could be possible, then at any given point, they will have the most interesting thoughts of what could happen, work on it. And then as soon as they learn more, they go towards the next step. And I think that's kind of what humankind, you know, I grew up in Heidelberg where Hegel was doing a lot of his stuff. And that's how history has always evolved, right? You have some kind of thesis, some kind of idea, then someone comes with a better one, and then you kind of synthesize that and go to the next level. And a lot of times you might not see it coming, but that's the beauty of it. That's the beauty of having people who are curious, smart, and thoughtful. And so to me, the most important aspect, as we talked about earlier, is the humility of saying, I give you everything I have here, but at the same time, let's be aware we cannot know everything. And that's okay. That's part of life. Like that can also be joyful. As long as we then also think about how we can collectively rally around, like actually making the world, you know, a less kind of disturbing place as it is at the moment.
Well, okay. So I'm now going to have to change my career completely. I have to stop imagining that I can forecast tomorrow. And to your point, you know, stay open, alert, agile, aware. And I guess also, you know, finally, that sense of seeing the unexpected, not as something that's there to shock or surprise or potentially knock us off course, but actually the thing to pull us back onto a new course and maybe rather open up new innovations and ideas. Christian, I could probably keep chatting to you for the next 2, 3, 4 days, but sadly we've run out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it there. But people can find out more about your work on www.theserendipitymindset.com, or you can find out more about Christian in his book, which is Connect the Dots, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck, which of course is available in all good bookshops as well as on Amazon. And rather, that's it for this week. Until next time, this is Martin Raymond urging you to keep looking, keep listening, keep learning, to Christian's point, and of course, to keep asking what's new and what's next.